Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Arnoldberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Gungaloo Country in Queensland. And before we dive into our conversation today, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connection to land, sea and community.
The Lentil Intervention is an Australasian educational and advocacy platform dedicated to raising awareness about the current climate and health crisis.
And on this podcast, we invite guests to chat about topics that will inspire you to take action to improve your own health and the health of the planet.
So please subscribe to and share this podcast and visit our website for the full show notes.
And don't forget to buy us a coffee if you'd like to support our work.
Right, season 2, episode 45. We're really getting on here. So we've recently launched the Athletes for Nature campaign, which is a tribal movement of outdoor enthusiasts, not just athletes, anyone that's interested in the outdoors, that encourages more into the outdoors, partake in physical activity, and of course, take small actions to protect nature, incorporating a little bit of katiaki tangi. This campaign is, of course, just another component of what we're aiming to achieve with the Lentil Intervention. Not that we generally single out any of our wonderful supporters that buy us coffees, but a little while ago, Alan O'Brien bought us a coffee. So shout out to you, Alan. Thank you very much. And left us this message. Enjoying your work, both of you. Ben, you have inspired me to sign up for the Taupo Ultra 100 kilometers, which I'll be doing next month. So reality check, by the time we're now doing this episode, this event was postponed from October to December. It's still looking a little uncertain, unfortunately. But Alan, I'm thinking this episode might provide you with a little more inspiration. So Emma, let's bring him in.
All right. So I'm looking forward to today's chat. I think we're likely being joined by our biggest adrenaline junkie yet, Jono Lester. So Jono is a third generation racing driver who's been in the driver's seat since age 13. Jono has competed professionally in a wide range of motorsports, but he's not just a certified petrol head. He's also an avid trail runner, an SPCA ambassador, and follows a plant-based diet. So lots to talk about today. Jono, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. No pressure. What an intro. Lovely. No, it's really great to join you guys. And look, by the sounds of it, you've been doing this a while now. So I hope I can live up to expectation.
Coming from you, I think you'll be driving us through this show. See what I did there?
All right. We'll start tallying the puns up now.
Here we go. Jono, let's start off with this. Your social media bio states the following: I love driving fast, running far, and eating plants. We can definitely talk at length about the latter two, and we will. But first, you'll need to educate us about the driving part. So let's start about you, your background. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. Well, I guess you could probably understand that that's the side of my life that I get asked about the most, particularly in an interview or a podcast situation. So I'm always trying to find ways of, communicating it in a way that's new for people, because for me it's kind of just going through the motions. But I understand, particularly with people who aren't involved in motor racing, it's probably a little bit easy to gloss over what we do is just sort of being the norm for me. But if we rewind it back to the very start, basically I grew up in a motor racing family, so I was probably desensitized to how cool and special and different my upbringing was to most people, certainly my classmates, my friends at school. I'd talk about race cars and things and like very blasé, and they would always be asking questions, what's it all about? And I could never quite relate to why they thought it was so exciting. To me, it was just what I grew up with. So I had a family right from my grandparents down who were involved in the sport. So the Manfield circuit down in the Manawatu, which is where I'm from, the whole process to build that circuit was headed up by my grandparents. And then once the circuit was built in the 1970s, they then ran it until their retirement. So for over 30 years, they Nana essentially ran the office administration side. Pop was a promoter. Pop was also a driver as well. He got into driving in his 40s, so he was a late starter. But to become a better promoter, he wanted to obviously understand what racing drivers needed and how they thought. So he started driving to try and complement his day job, if you like. And then as the children and then grandchildren came, we grew up in this environment. So my father was a driver, my auntie as well. All three generations have all been national champions in their various disciplines. My auntie went on to, I guess, a non-motor racing life, but her son, so my cousin, he also races professionally now. So we've got two third generation drivers in the family in different parts of the world competing professionally. But in my particular case, once I was born, Dad stepped out of the driver's seat and made his career out of motor racing as a coach. So you know all about that, Ben, with running and multi-sport. My father was very much the same, very good at it. I think probably better at that than he was at driving. He'd be readily admit that. That was his forte, was, you know, bringing up young talent all the way up to Formula One and all widths and breadths around it. So I had a very good coach in that sense. So I didn't grow up actually wanting to drive race cars, to be honest. Again, I think, as I said earlier, I was a little bit desensitized to it. I was always at the racetrack after school, more than I wanted to be. You know, as a kid, you want to be playing with your friends and doing other things. And I, a lot of the time, it was probably too much of a good thing. So I took it for granted a lot. And probably, as you can imagine, the day that all changed was the day that I actually got to drive one. So my 13th birthday present from my dad was a day in a small open wheel race car, kind of, I guess, your first step out of a go-kart into a real car. So similar in look and feel, that the open cockpit with your head sticking out like you see with Formula One and things, but far more basic. And I, one of my most fond and vivid memories right from day one was that first exit out of pit lane, driving that car, plucking gears, and from that moment, that was all I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and here we are. So so I guess changed my entire life focus from that point. Went through the junior categories here. The way it works in motor racing, because there's a heavy financial component and a heavy technological component, is it takes a very long time for you to go from paying to play. All right? A lot of people don't realize that. People look at it with rose-tinted glasses and just see all of the glitz and the glamour and the champagne and the fast cars and all of that, and think that we're living the life, which, if you can crack it, it's great. But to actually get there, it's a real one percenters game, and it takes a long time. In my particular case, 10 years of begging, borrowing, stealing, raising sponsorship, hundreds of thousands of dollars even here. You know what, one season in the Porsche Championship I did here before I turned pro was still $300,000, and that's just to race locally. So you can imagine when you go international, if you still haven't turned professional and started recouping some of that cost, it heads up into the millions and just becomes incredibly unsustainable, and for most Kiwis, impossible. So came up through the ranks, as you do, got good results, had good people behind me, really supportive family, sponsors, you know, a good unit around me in that sense. Obviously, all of the trials and tribulations of being a young athlete, finding yourself, finding the right regimen and the right, you know, sort of process that works for you, again, through trial and error. I'm still learning that today, as we all are, I think, in our various disciplines. And yeah, so as of 2012, when I got offered a drive that I got paid for, I've been a professional ever since. So sort of coming up 10 years now, that certainly eases the burden a lot. The hardest thing in our game is raising the money to go and do it. But it doesn't get any easier to stay pro once you've got there. I was under the impression that once I did, it would get a lot easier and it would be plain sailing. But if you let your standards slip, you can just as easily be on the scrap heap. So, yeah, so that's kind of a a quick little roundup of what I do. I guess insofar as specifics, the cars that I race are called GT cars. So like, I guess like running in a way, there's different types of running, right? You got sprinters, you got track, you've got cross country, you've got ultra running, you've got marathon, etc. We're very much the same. There's different viable pathways to make a career out of it. And in my case, I've gone down what's called the GT route. So it's your sexy, aspirational supercars that most young guys grow up wanting, whether that's to drive or to race or to own, your Ferraris and McLarens and Lamborghinis and that kind of stuff, which I'm not complaining about. I love it. And I love the variety that it's afforded me in my driving career. And whilst I've done little bits and pieces in other types of cars, that's sort of been my bread and butter until COVID. But that's another story, which I'm sure we'll cover in this chat. So, yeah, I mean, that's a little bit of a rundown of what I do. I get to travel the world, again, without COVID, driving fast cars and working with some incredibly talented people throughout each of the teams that I drive with, because it is obviously a team sport. You know, real boffin, you know, sort of NASA sort of level engineers who can make these cars do things they should not do. And when you can put all of those pieces together with me at the helm, you can make a really beautiful thing. I think it's a dance what we do, you know, if you can do it right. So yeah, so that's been most of my life in a nutshell, is driving race cars.
Now, before we get into anything further, I do just have to jump in and ask, because this, full disclosure, this will probably be the only podcast episode my dad ever listens to of ours because of the topic.
How are you, Dad? How's it going?
Yeah, shout out to Dad. So I've got to ask some details about the cars here. Number one, what's your favourite car? And number two, I grew up in a bit of a petrol head family. I don't know if this rivalry kind of crossed the ditch, but when I was growing up, it was very much Ford or Holden. So I have to ask, which side of the fence do you fall on?
God, I'm probably not gonna impress your dad too much here. I'm not actually a car guy. Okay. I just like driving, and so I get asked these questions a lot, and it's very hard for me to find a definitive answer, because I'm not a mechanic. I don't have a clue what goes on under the hood, but I love the challenge of getting the most out of a race car and making it go fast. The Ford Holden thing, growing
probably
up, we had all. I actually followed that. That was my pathway originally, was to go the V8 route. We ended up going a different way, but I tested a couple of the V8 supercars and things when I was younger, and those guys are some of the most talented drivers in the world, and that championship is arguably probably the most competitive, because the cars are so difficult to drive. But we had the Bathurst parties growing up on friends' farms. I have great memories of that. You know, everybody stacked up on potato crates with couches and with their red and their blue on. I guess as a family, we probably steered more towards Holden. I never really had an affiliation myself, but we had an involvement with Greg Murphy's career early on. When I say we, my father more than me, obviously. So that we kind of leaned that way in following him. But I couldn't say that I have a, you know, a priority either way or a preference either way. And so far as my favorite car, again, that sort of comes, it's similar to like being asked what your favorite fruit is, right? Like it might change day to day on your mood or what have you, or the experience that accommodates it. And so I think in motor racing, you end up choosing the vehicle that you perhaps perform the best in your career. That becomes your favorite, right? Because it carries these great memories along with it. So in my case, that would be the 458 Ferrari, which is the previous iteration of the current one, before they went turbocharged and took a lot of the soul out of them, in my opinion. And I had some just epic experiences in that vehicle, 2015, actually down under here in Australia and New Zealand, I had a bit of a lull period with Asia, and I raced back down under, and that's still the car that I felt I was the most in tune with. It almost felt effortless, so I've got some great memories of that car. Yeah.
Well, this conversation got instantly relatable when you said you don't have a clue what goes on under the bonnet, which means, yes,
there you go.
He's one of us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny how we're actually spending quite a bit of time on this because it's fascinating. It's interesting, especially when we're not, especially me, you know, I mean, my dad, other than religiously on a Sunday watching Formula One, it's for me, a car's a car. And oof, that's a bad thing to say to probably here. But I know you've mentioned this to me a little while ago. And let's just touch on it briefly, the future of motorsport. You mentioned that you're quite excited to see the now the introduction of electric vehicles. Because in this day and climate, the word climate, I guess we're becoming a lot more aware of our impact on the planet. For athletes, it's a difficult one, depending on different sports. I mean, even pro cyclists now are starting to recognize that, hey, our career means we're traveling the world, we're racing, there's the entourage, that's having a big impact. So what do you do? You know, do you just stop the sport altogether and say, no, no longer meets with our needs, or do you try and adapt to the best that you can? So yeah, tell us where you see the sport going. I mean, it's already happening, electric vehicles.
That's right. And to be perfectly honest with you, going plant-based coming up 3 years ago put me in a bit of a conflict of crisis in a way, because I was living my passion in one sense, driving race cars, but in many ways that doesn't now fit with the way that I aspire to live ethically. And so with the movement to electric vehicles, I have a solution somewhat, you know, maybe not carbon neutral, but it's a lot better. I still stand by the fact that when you're looking at your individual carbon footprint, if you're living a plant-based lifestyle and being very mindful of waste and other things, you're still doing far better than people who are driving a four-wheel drive gas guzzler every day anyway, insofar as your overall footprint. We three of us all know that going plant-based is the single biggest impact you can have as an individual. However, you know, if you're engaging in conversation with people who perhaps don't understand that, they can quite easily look at what you do. And Lewis Hamilton's a great example, obviously, as a prominent racing driver who's plant-based. It's very easy to people to throw out the, well, maybe in his case, he's in a private jet, but regardless, you're driving a racing car for a living, and yet you're preaching to us about the planet and the environment and animal rights and yada, yada, yada. And unfortunately, a lot of these people don't actually care that what the real reasoning behind that is, or the truth behind that is. They just see an easy target there. But the electric side of things, man, my dad hates that I say this. He's a purist, but I am all for it. And I'm all for it because, like I say, for me, it fits. I could wake up every day and feel like that everything lines up now with the way that I now see the world, having gone plant-based. And again, plant-based initially for my health, but then obviously all of the surrounding ethical and environmental aspects of it become core to you as well, which I think a lot of people find. You know, not everybody goes vegan for the animals, as the term is, straight away, but maybe that comes later. So yeah, going electric, my particular sector of motor racing is kind of the next cab off the rank there. So there's been a few pilot programs, if you like, in different forms of motor racing that have done so. Formula E being the top of the pile. We've got three top Kiwi drivers in there already. Mitch Evans, Nick Cassidy, Tom Blomqvist. Now it's moving into more of what I do, sports cars, GT cars. I think that by maybe the end of 23, there will be a viable test product in place where the manufacturers can start building a fit for purpose electric car. And that would mean that the form of racing that I'm in, where BMW, Porsche, Ferrari, all of these brands are now currently slotting in their combustion engine versions of these cars. They will replace those fleets with e-vehicles, and it will become the future landscape and the future blueprint, I guess, of what I do. That'll be at the tail end of my career. I can thankfully, I've got quite good career longevity in GT. You can race well into your 40s in what I do. It's a little bit less cutthroat in that sense compared to things like Formula One, where you're a bit more like a rugby player, where if you're in your mid-30s, you're doing well, you know. But if I can be a part of that switch to e-racing before my time is out, then that'd be, a really satisfying way for me to finish my time as a driver. Yeah.
Have you been on site and watched any e-racing in person? Is it weirdly quiet?
I haven't in person, though, but the Kiwis who are in Formula E, one of them in particular is a good friend of mine. We raced in Japan together, and I've asked him at length, just through Instagram chats and all, what the whole change to electric is like. And of course, one of the biggest challenges as a show is to keep it exciting, because motor racing as an entertainment package is intended to be something that's visceral to all the senses, and sound is a very big part of that. In fact, in most cases, without the sound, the speed that you see with your eyes perhaps doesn't actually seem quite as spectacular. So that's something that I think is a huge challenge for the the people that are driving this change and this movement. But insofar as a driver's concerned, you actually have to adapt the way that you drive the car massively, because without getting too technical, with a normally aspirated car with a combustion engine, when you're braking, heavy braking into a corner from a couple of hundred mile an hour, the engine is actually doing half of the work for you. Now, the easiest, little bit of relatability for people is when you go into a rural town and you see the no engine braking signs for trucks, which we see all over NZ. I'm sure you see it as well. And if you hear them coming in without obeying that, you hear the change in noise that the trucks make, because they have a little toggle switch or whatever it may be, which essentially slows the truck down without the use of the brakes. It's using the torsion and the inertia within the engine to reduce the speed of the vehicle through friction and whatnot, and all of these complicated things that most people listening probably don't care about. But if you translate that across to electric racing, because you just got an electric battery now, the whole way in which you slow the vehicle down, which is part through listening, with a standard vehicle, if you like, and part through the way that you modulate your pressure to maximize the braking force without locking up your tires and making the car skid off the road, that's completely turned on its head with an electric vehicle. So not only will changing to that type of racing be different for the fans, but it's a huge shift and a new challenge for drivers too, which again, as an athlete, you want. There comes a time after many years where it gets a little bit stale no matter what you're doing. You want something fresh, something new to challenge yourself. And so that's another reason why that prospect excites me. Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. Partially because I'm
glad you think so.
It really is. I mean, the closest I have to an EV is an electric skateboard. But this is truly fascinating, because it's a big part of the world, transport, and a lot of people, you know, New Zealand and Australia are very car heavy. You know, the majority are not racers, but you know, it's the whole concept of the change. Now, you've mentioned longevity in your sport,
yes,
in your career. What does it take to be an athlete? I mean, there's a big, in terms of training, the physicality, because Formula One, we know there's a lot of the G-forces associated with that.
Sure.
Do you have the same with GT racing? What is a typical, you know, training regimen that's required or expected of a motor car racer?
It's an imperfect science, I'll tell you that much, because it's not a type of sport where you can train for your sport by doing your sport. I'd love to be in a car every day, because there's no better fitness for motor racing than what we call race fitness, i.e. driving. The knowledge and the science and the data that's available today, which the sports specialists are working with their drivers, will be exponentially better a year from now, and so on and so on, as the, you know, as the technological age that we live in brings in more and more development. So as we all know, with all sports, whether it's powered by a car or powered by your feet, the technology that goes into excelling, we are so fortunate these days. But in what I do as a driver, it's a little bit different to Formula One. We obviously don't carry as much speed as they do with their heavily downforce ridden cars. So the wings and all that those vehicles have on them have enough what we call downforce, i.e. pressure sucking them to the ground. You may have heard this analogy before, that they can actually drive on the roof of a tunnel without falling to the ground. That's how much pressure those wings generate. GT is a bit different. We rely a lot more on what's called mechanical grip. So grip that's essentially generated by the tires and the way that you drive it, rather than the downforce that the car is generating. So we do get some G-forces, but most of what we have to combat is, I guess, a more rounded physical challenge. You've got a little bit of G-force, you've got a higher rate of input required, i.e. muscular wise, through the steering wheel and the pedals. So you know, you've each braking application is the equivalent of like 120 kilo leg press. You've really got to hit it hard. And then the steering input as well. If any of you guys have ever gotten a car that's not started and moving and doesn't have the power steering, you know how hard it is to turn, right? So you can imagine the faster you go, the harder and harder that gets again. So strong core as a base, like a lot of, well, like most sports, but then all of your extremities, your legs, your arms and your neck need to obviously be in tune around that. But the single biggest thing that that we as GT drivers need to train ourselves for is the heat, because we're in a closed cockpit. We don't have any aircon or any of those luxuries, because A, they add weight to the vehicle, and B, if you have them on, they sap a little bit of the engine power, and even 1% is too much. So you can imagine in climates like Asia, where I predominantly race, it can be pretty uncomfortable, you know, on a good day, let alone a bad day. To give you a little bit of context or a little bit of perspective on that, you know, on a cool day, you'll still be over 50 degrees in the cabin. And on a hot day, it can be up into the early mid 60s. Now, if you tack on, if you're claustrophobic, it's not the job for you, man. but you obviously tack on to that our three layers of fireproof overalls, which is made of a fiber that's like your nana's old, really scratchy woolen blankets that you have at her house. I remember those back in the day. They give me nightmares. Granted, they've got a little bit more comfortable these days, but you are wearing three layers of protection from the threat of fire there. Obviously, the helmet, which is heavily padded. There's no room in there. Like your cheeks are squashed up like a fish, and there's very little room for air to circulate. And then you've got, obviously, you're strapped as tight as humanly possible, and I'm talking like when you first have your shoulder straps pulled down, you can't inhale. It's like you've been winded, because once you get out onto the track and the body relaxes, your body naturally, I guess, recoils a bit and they loosen off. So you are, you know, you're strapped into this little missile with all of this heat and absolutely no ability to move. And you've got to be out there for, I mean, a minimum 1 hour per stint. And a stint is essentially the length of a tank of gas or the distance a set of tires will last before they need to be changed. Now, in the racing I do, which is endurance racing, we race typically, a short race would be an hour. That's what we call a sprint. But these races go anywhere up to 24 hours. I guess you call them the ultra of racing, in a sense. So endurance is the discipline that I do predominantly. And you have a roster of typically two or three drivers that rotate throughout the race. But you may do anywhere from one to three stints in the car at once. So let's say you are in there for 3 hours and you've got that amount of heat and you're obviously working physically. You've got a water bottle system, which within 15 minutes is useless because the freezing water that you're drinking becomes hot. You've got what's called a cool suit, which has membranes in a vest that you wear that pumps dry ice through it, which fails 50% of the time and then becomes a hot bath. So I steer clear of them altogether because of the risk factor. There's no way to combat that heat other than to be extremely physically fit to obviously come up or go up against those challenges. And as you guys know, with any physical endeavor, the moment that you're past the, I guess, your physical limits, I guess, out of that state of homeostasis where the engine's running a little bit hot, the internal engine I'm talking about here, then that begins to occupy your mental space. And the moment that you switch off and stop focusing on the job at hand, which at 180, 200 miles an hour, it's pretty important to be split inch perfect, you know. So the moment your physical side starts to waver, your mental side follows suit, and that's when the danger really comes into motor racing. So there's no real direct way of doing that other than just being generally very fit. And you'll find that the fittest and in most cases most successful racing drivers follow a training program that typically involves or any form of triathlon based discipline, whether they do all three, a lot of them do triathlons as part of their training, or whether you choose running as your discipline or you choose cycling, which is what the bulk of them do. I think they like wearing lycra and posting it on Instagram. And there's a sort of running joke within the industry of the lycra brigade, particularly Porsche. Their factory drivers love getting it in their lycra and plastering it all over Instagram. But whatever discipline you choose, it has to be about doing long sessions at obviously, if you can try and mimic the heart rate you are in the car, then that has some relatability to what you're doing as a driver. But let's be honest here, unless you're in the middle of the Sahara or you've got a massive heat chamber to do that in, you're still not going to mimic that heat. So the easiest way to become comfortable with that is to be in that environment as much as possible. And it never becomes nice. It's always uncomfortable, but some days it's hell and others you can manage it. And obviously you'd rather the latter than the former.
Sounds like such a pressure cooker environment.
Yeah, literally.
Really quickly, before we kind of get into some other topics, how long does it take you to recover from a race?
I think when you're young and dumb and you know, full of hot air, probably you think it doesn't take you long at all. But as we all know, as we get older and a little bit more wise, you need to have the self-awareness to to listen to your body and know when to switch off. Your shorter races, you know, your races where you might be in the car and race day for an hour, hour and a half, it's not so bad. It's not so bad at all, to be honest. The only time that kind of event would really tax you is if you are in a really intense battle with someone where the stakes are high. Perhaps you're battling for the lead, or you're in a torrential rainstorm where the risk factor goes up massively because the likelihood of crashing goes up. If one of those factors comes into play where the adrenaline peaks beyond what just a normal, you know, circulating around and around and around would be, then you can certainly feel pretty drained the next day. But it's your 12, 24, you know, even 6 hour races that really take a toll. And it's more mentally, you know, it takes a couple of days to, I guess, come back down to earth, not only from the physical and mental act of driving, but also the atmosphere of a race. You spend these 3 or 4 days in kind of in a like Alice in Wonderland, where you're not doing something that you know, your normal human beings ever get to experience. You're in a it's like an adult theme park. Like, I don't think I've ever grown up. When you're at a race, you've got the atmosphere and the fans and the crowds, and you're driving these amazing cars, and you are on a high, a natural high the whole time. And then you get home and you walk in the front door, and you feel flat. It's like, man, I'd love to live in that space forever. So the two, you know, the actual taxing, the draining of doing the driving, but also coming back down to earth, coming back to reality, that can be its own little form of depression for a couple of days for people, you know, and then usually come Wednesday, you're just back into it. So yeah, I mean, it's a constant roller coaster of emotion and adrenaline and endorphins and whatnot. But I guess like anything that triggers those chemicals, they're very addictive. You have to keep going back for more, right? So that's why I keep doing what I do.
Now, we've spoken a little bit, you've touched on a little bit on the concept of recovery. And you mentioned, you know, the importance of what you do for the training. So let's now talk about your journey to plant-based. You transitioned about 3 years ago. You said it was predominantly for your health at the start. Why? Yes. How did you come across it? Why did you choose plant-based and not another version of another diet, which we're not going to mention, but, you know, there's so much floating around in sporting communities. Why did you choose plant-based? Sure. How did you make it happen? Did you have the support of your team? Did you have to fight them back on it?
I think you probably had a lot of guests that you've asked this question to, and I would imagine that not many of them have a conventional answer for this. You know, we all find our way to this lifestyle in different ways. There's certainly no roadmap to changing your life so drastically, because I believe it's the single biggest fundamental change that I've made ever, to be honest, because it impacts every aspect of your life so heavily. So in my personal case, we've got a really, really, excuse my language, but we've got a really shitty existence at times as drivers, where you get to the Christmas period where everyone's loving their holidays, spending time with their family, going to festivals, out on the boat, whatever they do. And I can count 1 year out of my entire career where I've been at that time of year and actually known if I've had a job next year, because there is bugger all longevity and long-term contracts in this sport, unless you are contracted to a specific manufacturer like a Porsche or whoever. So when you're young, you can power through all that by being stubborn. But as you get a bit older, it gets a little bit harder at times when you feel a bit hard done by because you've had a great season. But that doesn't translate into a great contract for the next year. And in this particular instance, end of 2018, I'd had the best year I've ever had. I think I won one in every three of the races I did, across three championships with three teams and three cars. It was a really packed schedule. I felt like I was doing my job really well. And come the build-up to Christmas, none of them had renewed for me for various reasons. None of which were personal or down to my performance. But again, in a sport that's so money-driven, just because you're fast in a race car doesn't always mean that you're going to get a seat. And so I fell into a pretty bad rut. You know, I've struggled with depression in probably the last 5 years, and it's situational, like most people who suffer from it. I think I'm certainly not medicated for it. It's not a clinically diagnosed thing, but I mean, right now is a great example in lockdown. You know, situational depression will be at its all-time high, I think, for people, unfortunately. But I stopped training, which I hadn't done ever. I just had no desire to get out of bed or do any of the things that you know, that were part of my normal routine, which kept me active and kept me happy and whatnot, kept me pushing forward, if you like. And I can't remember which came first. Actually, no, I do. So the agency that I'm with that sort of handle some of my brand alignments and things with things like the SPCA and plant-based food brands and stuff, one of the owners of that agency is Adam Thompson, who was a former All Black, won the World Cup with them 10 years ago. We became good buddies when I joined the agency, and he had a really scary incident. He was playing rugby in Japan, and he woke up one day in agony, screaming in pain in the middle of the night up in Tokyo. And he had this, I might completely muck this up here, so if you're listening, Adam, I'm sorry, but he basically had this degenerative disease in his spine, which ate away at his discs, I think in his lower back. And long story short, he's in a foreign country where nobody speaks English, lying on a girdle, screaming with his partner in tears. And it took them like a couple of weeks to even diagnose what was wrong with him. And then he had a really long road ahead, not only to walk again, but to actually have any real mobility again. And he still had aspirations of playing rugby at this time. So I followed very closely, obviously as a friend, what he was doing. And the first thing that he and Jess did was that they moved to Bali. And they set up camp there, and he went plant-based through his whole recovery. And then he puts up this photo like 6 months later, and he looks 10 years younger, and he's ripped to shreds. Like, he looks amazing. And as a rugby player, you know, the stigma attached to that, you've got to be a man, you've got to eat meat, all of this. So for someone like him to champion this movement and show how it's benefited him, not only for his obviously recovery, but to then come back and rejoin Super Rugby at like 38 years old and become the father of the team, mentoring young guys coming through as well as playing. It was a really profound thing to see. And it certainly made me stand up and take notice of what he'd done to obviously to reach that peak, and that was going plant-based. So I'm sort of sitting around and bugger all, feeling sorry for myself. So I was like, all right, well, like everything, I need to investigate this. I need to do a little bit of research, because I've always loved fitness. I've experimented with every different kind of training regimen, diet regimen, whatever that you can think of. And every time you think you've cracked it, you find something else. And it wasn't until I went plant-based, I realized that they were all nonsense. but anyway, we all know that now because we've done it. So I started doing the research, started reading books. I was reading, Thrive by Brendan. Forget his name, but and read all sorts of books. And then I came across Rich Roll. And through reading Rich's book and the his story really resonated with me. But then the practical stuff in both Thrive and Rich's book and a couple of other resources that not only said, hey, this is a good lifestyle, but here's how to implement it into your life as an athlete. That was the trigger for me, because it's all well and good being told something, but if you're not given a roadmap, what's the point? Like, this is such a huge change in everything you do in life. I mean, food is like, what do we do day to day that has more of an impact on our life than food? Like there's very little. And even just the dilemma of looking in your pantry and saying, well, cool, what am I going to refill this with? If you don't have that knowledge, then how are you going to ever get started? So I think I spent 3 or 4 months reading books, making lists in my Trello. I had Trello boards for Africa with links and infographics, and I was making a plan. I'm very OCD like this. And then eventually I was like, okay, well, now we need to put it into action. So my best mate, Sam, who I was living with at the time, he'd been in a bit of a rut too, and for his own personal reasons. And so I banged on his door and I was like, hey, bro, I was like, do you want to go plant-based for a month? And he's like, yeah. He's like, he'd seen Tomo do it as well, Adam Thompson. And he said, yeah, whatever. Like, him and I, like, we don't, if we ask the other to do something, you know, the jump off a bridge scenario, we would do it together. We're just that kind of friendship. Anyway, so he said, yeah, why not? We'll do it. So so we went all in. Well, to be fair, we went partially in. I retained eggs for the first week, but everything else went. Dairy went, meat went. And, you know, initially you're just living on things like pit-a-pit and tank and whatever until you actually figure out how to cook some things and what staples you need to not only eat plant-based, but eat whole food plant-based, because, you know, a junk food vegan is no better than eating meat, at least health-wise. So I felt so good after 4 or 5 days that it was easy to drop eggs. I mean, there's no better indicator than how you feel, right? And the not only the mental clarity and the sleep quality was the biggest one for me. And obviously, you know, the regenerative power of sleep, if you've got that on point, if you've got that really nailed, then that's where the recovery benefits of eating a plant-based diet are at work, doing their thing, right? So if you're reducing inflammation and you're sleeping well, then of course you're going to be able to keep hitting new peaks, resting less, training harder, longer, more often, without waking up feeling like an old man every day. And so I was just fascinated once I started to see these little, you know, these little benefits slowly but surely come in. And in fact, they weren't slow. They happened quick. I mean, to notice things within a handful of days, I think's fast. I know a lot of people want a instant fix, you know, like a coffee or whatever else. But as we all know, life doesn't work that way. And I guess as an endurance athlete, I understand the rationale of doing things for the long term and being patient. So it was the influence of Tomo and of Rich Roll. I mean, man, I've got like a man crush on Rich. Like, I've got to tell you, he is honestly number one on my list for that, you know, that dinner party. Who would you have at the dream dinner party? I just think he's the most eloquent communicator on the planet, and the people he speaks to and the places they can go and their chats. You know, there's no form of media I'm more engaged with than his podcast. And so he's been, you know, people talk about influences, people having influence, you know, again, and I'm doing inverted commas on the video for those listening. That's obviously a term thrown around very, very willy-nilly these days. But he's a person who, if he told me he was using X running shoe, or he was using Y mattress, or he was wearing this shirt while he was running, I've bought dozens of things that he's recommended.
So do you so that's outside in a tent?
No, not yet.
Haven't gone that far.
But funnily enough, I have considered it. I just need to. I need a little bit more. Need a little bit more space before I go down that road. But yeah. So those particular two examples that really resonated with me at a time where I needed a little bit of light in my life, and I'm really pleased that it happened that way, because obviously it's always darkest before the dawn, right? And so. You know, I think without the challenges I was going through with my career, I would, you know, without going through that, I probably would still just be living life exactly the way I always had been. And there'd be all of these other amazing things that I'm now, you know, lucky enough to have in my life, which wouldn't be present. So, yeah, so that's how it came to be in a very long way. I talk a lot, man. I hope you weren't hoping to compress this into 30 minutes, because I do go on. So stop me if you need to move on to the next question.
Brilliant. We've got all the time we need, so go
okay.
for it.
All good.
I'm really interested in knowing, though, how your team actually reacted to your change, because you mentioned football before being like a blokey kind of sport, but I mean, motorsports are pretty testosterone-filled arenas as well. And at the start of the conversation, you also mentioned Lewis Hamilton. He's probably one of the world's best known plant-based eaters currently. So has that also had any impact? Like, I would imagine you probably got a little bit of shit to begin with when you first transitioned.
Honestly, less than I expected. And which was great, because it is a blokey sport. If you look at a team garage, you know, your mechanics and your engineers, they are your pie eating, beer drinking, blokey blokes, for the most part. And so they'd, you know, typically be those who would give you stick if you were to tell them that you were following this new lifestyle. And it's funny that you say that, because I sat down with an engineer who fit that exact stereotypical profile. Great guy, an absolute genius when it comes to making these cars dance, as I've said earlier in the podcast. And he's a big fella, you know, and he loves drinking piss, and he, you know, he's just a lad, right? And we had a bit of a heart-to-heart over dinner at an event in Thailand, and I don't know how we got onto the topic, but when at the moment I mentioned it, his ears pricked up, like genuinely, not looking for dirt to throw, and he started asking me questions. And like, I'd only been following the plant-based lifestyle, if you like, for maybe 3 months at this point. But I'd done the research in the months leading up, so I was certainly far more adept at talking about it than he was. And so I was still able to, I think, impart some compelling, you know, reasoning behind why I've done it. But also for somebody who's not an athlete, but just might be conscious about their health, some reasons why, you know, it could help him. And we finished up this chat and basically finished up with him saying, you know, when I get back to Australia, I'm going to have a chat with my wife, but I think I'm going to try this for over the Christmas break, because it's the time of year where most people pile on 3 or 4 kilo and drink too much and end up starting the new year feeling pretty average, you know, or the new working year after the holidays or whatever it may be. And that sort of situation, that conversation really surprised me in a pleasantly surprised me, you know, it was in a good way and made me a little bit less self-conscious about talking about it, because it is such a trigger point for so many people, food. You know, people don't like being told what to eat. And even if you're not preaching, because it's the last thing I would ever do, I've been super, super... nothing makes me more anxious than doing a social media post about this. It's getting better, but I've never put more thought into how a caption is worded than when it's around this, because people like, it's like the vaccine, and I'm not going down that road, but people, once they hear that word, it's just like ferocious. It divides people, even if people are trying to have an educated conversation about something. So for him as a blokey bloke to open up and be receptive to what I was experiencing, that made me feel quite good. And you know, I guess it kind of cemented some of the reasons why I'm doing what I do. And if, you know, if you can get through to one or two people like that, even if they don't make the change, but if it's in their mind, then perhaps subliminally they might make little changes anyway that can not only help their own health, but perhaps the footprint they leave as well. So, I haven't had an adverse reaction from within the sport, to be honest. And it's, again, it's all in jest. I get the most stick from my dad, and he's got the typical boomer, you know, like, if you can't eat what we're cooking tonight, then you can always go and have a nibble on the grass in the backyard. And he keeps regurgitating that same line, and he laughs every time. It ain't funny, but again, I cooked a chickpea curry at his place once for myself, and I gave him some, and he really liked it. And then he had this heart to heart with me, and he's not a heart to heart type of guy by any means. And he kind of came around, and he said, you know, I don't pretend to know much about these new lifestyle choices, because I'm just an older guy, but if your food can taste that good, then I can see why you're doing it. And I was like, cool, there you go. You know, he might not change, but I feel like I got through to him a little bit there too. So so it's been predominantly positive, the feedback. Yeah.
Well, he does live in dairy country, so, you know, you can kind of forgive him.
That's
a little.
Right.
But you know, exactly what you've been saying is important. And we say this about ourselves here on the show, is that we've chosen not to take the activism part. We've chosen to take the educational, conversational type path, you know, because it is very easy to switch people off. It's very easy to trigger them into a response where it puts their guard down and they're not open to a conversation that could be more based on facts, science, etc. And, you know, we're a big believer in action, and the way, you know, we talk about a plant-based lifestyle. It's how you live. You don't need to be posting or talking about it. You know, how do you know someone's a vegan? They'll tell you, you know, that kind of thing. It's just live the way you choose to live, and the plant-based way of living, it's just people will observe that. And because you're not preaching, but they'll look and say, oh, what are you eating? Looks good. Looks better than my dish. It's more colorful. It's this and that. And then, like your story here, then it sort of generates a conversation. And because it's done in a manner that's non-judgmental, and non, you know, it's people are more open to that change than themselves. And you've done that job, because you've taken the soft approach, the respectful approach, but you've let them come to you just by the way you're living. You're exhibiting a way that actually that's quite appealing. That's, you know, it's not, you know, holding up a placard or bashing people down.
Well, it's very easy for people to forget that they, in most cases, that they once ate meat and dairy too. So I feel like it's extremely hypocritical for you to take that preachy, judgmental approach. And you know, veganism is a pretty divided community too, because you've got people trying to be the perfect vegan. You've got people who are trying to make the changes incrementally. You've got people who might still eat a little bit of fish or might still have a little bit of dairy. And everybody's trying, but unless they fit this mold that certain people have in their mind, they get shot down in flames. And in a lot of cases, those people will revert back to the standard omni diet and they'll never come back. And I just think that's a real waste, you know? So that's kind of how I approach it as well. I mean, until 2.5 years ago, I did the same as everybody else. So I certainly can't get up on my ivory tower about any of their lifestyle choices. But like you say, if you can educate people, and if they're prepared to listen, I never start the conversation. That's the thing. If someone asks, we have a chat, but I certainly never try and engage in that way, because then I guess it can be misconstrued as you trying to force an agenda. So I let people come to me in that sense. And
so you wouldn't put a go vegan sticker on the back of your car. You wouldn't do that then, is what you're saying.
I'd probably do that, to be honest. I haven't been asked yet, but yeah, I'd probably do that. Yeah. Like those ones on the stop signs, eh? Yeah. But no, I'm it's been a, like I say, it's been a profound and very fulfilling and yeah, it's been the best thing I've ever done, like basically. It really has. So, yeah.
So let's talk about one of your more recent changes, or new interests rather, is ultra running, something that we share a little bit, finally.
Well,
plant-based lifestyle, but certainly not the driving. But yeah, why is that? Is that a COVID thing, you know, back in New Zealand looking for a new challenge? Or is that just another avenue now that you're finding, hey, I'm plant-based, so I've got all this energy, I can take on the world now? I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
I think, you know, ramping up the challenges and the goals to ultra distance are definitely a lockdown thing. But the interest in running began not long before that, to be honest. A good buddy of mine got dared by, or had a bet with his missus that he couldn't do a half marathon. And so he entered, or planned on entering, the Hawke's Bay half in 2018. So he hit me up, I think it was in January of that year, and he said, do you want to do it with me? And I said, yeah, cool. I mean, why not? Like, I've never really... Yeah, I used to go out for a 5K or whatever as part of your training, but I was by no means a runner. And I've never been more humbled than the first day of training, because I thought I was pretty fit. And I was training every day for a couple of hours, but my cardiovascular side was predominantly low intensity, you know, on a bike, things like that. And so you didn't have that shock factor and that impact of that only running can provide, right? And man, I remember I did like a 7 or 7.5K run around the neighborhood, and I couldn't walk up and down the stairs for 2 days. and I was like, what have I got myself into? And like any goal, you know, if it started with a half, and then you start shifting the goalposts. And so we did the half, and then I was mindful of the toll that road running takes on you. You know, I've struggled with back injuries in the past. I've got a L3, L4 compression and sciatica, and so these things can flare up. And obviously, it's easier to flare those things up if you're banging on the pavement all the time. So, so I can't remember how I came across it, but I think we were on such a high after the half marathon that we started Googling other events, and then we found the Xterra series. So of course still half marathon distance, but on the trails. So the moment we started training for that, and I lived in Karaka at the time, so the Hanuas were real nearby, and Waiuku, I'd go out in there, and not only were you in nature, which was hugely gratifying, like it was just so pleasant to be out in nature, and running became a mindfulness practice at that point. But you'd also be able to run equal or longer distance slash time and feel great the next day, you know? And with such an engaging, constantly changing scenery to keep your mind occupied. So that became, very quickly became my preference. And did the exteriors, loved them. I did pretty well in all of them. Like, I was sort of straight away placing like top 15 in that. And I think I was 20th in the Hawke's Bay half. And like, I don't do them to compare, but sorry, to compete. But of course, as a competitor, seeing those little things is like, well, maybe I could be top 10 and yada, yada, yada. So kind of just enjoyed doing that sort of distance for a little while. And then come lockdown, of course, it's like, well, what else are we going to do all day? You know, so started running more and more and more. And as has been the case more than once, I had a few little injury flare-ups. I did intend on doing the Tata Weta 100 or 102. When was it? It would have been last year, but obviously with COVID and all, and I had a flare-up with the same back injury that's bloody done me during this lockdown. Something that I'm constantly battling with, but anyway, that's another story for another day. But through the growing sort of interest in trail running, I started following Carl Reed on Strava, and I knew of Carl because obviously, you know, he's a pretty distinct looking fellow, right? Covered in tats, and he's got that all or nothing approach, which is just, I just think it's so cool. Coming from a sport where, you know, if I went out and drove as hard as possible on lap one, then I know that within half an hour I'd be at the back of the field because my tires would be shot and I'd probably blow the car up. So to see this guy who would go gangbusters, and even if he failed, would just keep coming back and trying and trying and trying and trying again, and obviously trying to do it better and change his approach and his diet and all to suit. I just found that fascinating. So we engaged a little bit on Strava just with our, you know, various bits and pieces, and turns out he's a rev head. And so when I found that out, I was like, well, okay, now we've got some real common ground. So I invited Carl and his wife Paula out to one of my races earlier in the year at Hampton Downs. And they spent, it was a miserable day, and they spent the entire day standing at the back of the garage, and he was so engaged. He was watching what every member of the team was doing. He was laser focused on the telemetry, all of the live data coming back to the pits from the car with all of our various parameters with what the car's doing and temperatures and things, you know, little alarms and whatnot. And you could see as an athlete, he was, I guess, fascinated by the intricacies of a different sport, as I have become with running. And so from that day, we straight away became good friends, and he'd obviously seen that I was ramping up my running, and the first thing he said to me was, you know, what sort of intentionality do you have with your program? And to be honest, at the time, I was only really, the only thing I really had a grasp on because of Rich was zone two. So I'd base a good portion of my training around building that zone two base, making sure I could stay in homeostasis. But I had no idea about the importance, even at ultra level, of speed work, whether it's intervals or hill sessions or just basically still having a good portion of that program in that tempo range and higher. Because I'd only really read in my limited reading about how to last a distance in a 100-mile or 100K race, it needs to be at a lower intensity. So naturally, obviously, you think that's how you should train. So he very quickly flipped the switch there, and he's basically been coaching me since. And it hasn't been long. It's been, I think since June. But the gains that I made in 3 months were incredible. And, you know, it was a consistent weekly, like, they weren't those tiny little gains that you couldn't see. You genuinely, you look at the data and they were significant. The speed you could run at, the length of time you could hold that intensity for, and how low you could get your heart rate doing it. I'm very data driven, being a driver. You know, we're a very data driven sport, so that kind of stuff just fueled my fire. And and so our intention was to train specifically for the Auckland Marathon, which obviously has now been canned, and then get through that at the end of October, which would have been what, 2 days from now, and then shift the focus to Tarawera for Feb. And it was all going great, and then I bloody did my back end at the start of this lockdown, which set me into a bit of a spiral, and I had to have, man, I think I was sedentary for 5 weeks, and I was miserable, man. Like, it was the only thing that gave me any purpose during lockdown was getting out running. So it wasn't fun, but now I wouldn't say starting from scratch again, but 5 weeks when you're doing nothing, I wasn't even able to really walk. Was unable to get any treatment during level 4, obviously. So now coming back into it, you've got to really reposition your expectations. And that's a bitter pill to swallow, because you see 6 months of work lost in 5 weeks. And then it's the little niggly injuries that pop up as you're trying to get back up to pace. And I think I've gone back out too hard again, because I've got bloody shin splints at the moment. So I'm now being told I can't run for another week again, and I've just got to walk and hike and do yoga. But it's better than doing nothing. You know, I'd rather do that than be holed up in bed. So my goal and my intention most certainly is to be an ultra runner, but don't tag me with or tar me with that brush yet, Ben, because I haven't earned it. But when I do, I will be looking at 100 mile, I guess. I mean, you've got to keep finding the next goal, right? I've done a couple of marathon distance trail events like T42 and stuff, and I loved it. And even just going from a half to a full on the trails added so many new challenges, you know, and that's only over the course of 4 hours, let alone 10 or 20. So I'm under no illusion of how difficult 100K or 100 miler will be. But one thing I do have in my arsenal, which I know will be an asset, and it's already proved itself to be an asset even in those shorter distances, is having a really good grasp of how to pace myself, because it's what I've done my whole life. So I believe that that's really going to help me when the time comes, you know, when the body allows me to. So I love it. It's been massively important addition to my life, to my happiness, my mental health, all of that. When you can do it, but I think, like a lot of things, you know, if you place too much importance on that or too much pressure on yourself, which I think I've done, then when that gets taken away all of a sudden, like it did recently, then it's like, what, you got to find something else to get you out of bed in the morning, right? I can't go racing, I can't run, you can't do various other things while we're stuck inside. So I still need to work on running being a passion, but not being an obsession where it becomes unhealthy. Plenty of good things can become unhealthy, you know, and I've always had a problem with that. I go all in, and I go really all in, and if that can backfire on you in certain ways as well. So that's all part of learning and growth, right? So I love running. I probably love it more than driving race cars now. You know, no, I spend the amount of time in my day I spend thinking about running is really sad. Like, if you split my day up, it's like that much is just thinking about running. So, yeah. Sorry, Dad.
that's potentially where you are now. Look, coming from my personal experience, once you do the 100 miler, I don't think I need to look a bigger goal. I'm happy to go back to 50 milers and 100Ks. I don't need to keep pushing that limit. But actually, just a follow-on question, and I'm conscious we're going to have to land this plane soon, but the one thing I do want to ask is, someone who is driven, as someone who's so used to riding the high, a lot of the highs, you know, with your motor racing and more recently with running, and you talk about that connection with, you know, running in nature, and that's something that we talk about. There's good science, good research that shows the mental health benefits, the immune system benefits, all these personal, physical, health-related benefits of immersing yourself in nature. Shinrin-yoku is a Japanese term. There's forest bathing. There's all sorts of other concepts. So for someone like yourself, you and I, especially a lot of our listeners in Auckland, we're at the time of the recording now, 11 weeks already, and it's going to continue for a while. Lockdown, we're restricted with where we can go. You've been bedridden. Give us one little bit of insight or maybe a tip more so. Maybe it's a lesson learned. Maybe you didn't necessarily do it, but think on reflection, that's what you should have done. How do you handle those slumps, the real slump? You know, going from one extreme to the other. You can't get into nature. I mean, I live in central Auckland, so for those first few weeks, I couldn't even drive to the Hunua Forest. You know, I'm stuck in the city, and I've had my moments. But how? What would you impart as, from a professional athlete's perspective, from a personal perspective, when people hit that slump, that real, I can't get out and do what I love? What's that tip? What should you focus on? What should you do?
Oh man, this is one of those questions where, the answer is generally not what people want to hear. You know, like, I mean, we're holed up at home, like you say. If you do find your outlet in running, let's say in nature, and that's taken away from you, I mean, there's obviously no real easy fix for that. But if you still can find some way to move every day, you know, movement's key. And that's why, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, even though I got to take a few days off running as we speak, I can still do yoga. I can still do some mobility. I can still get outside. I can still be out in the fresh air. And even if it's only wandering around the neighborhood, that does more than it's probably given credit for. Just movement. You know, we are not, as we know, although we'd like to forget sometimes, we are not made to sit down or lie down all day. That's not what we are designed for. So, I mean, providing you're not bedridden, that's probably got to be number one. And, you know, the other, and much easier said than done if you're feeling down as well, because perhaps you are being restricted from what you want. But if you can, and it's probably even harder than the movement one, but if you can, still eat well, you know. that's an easy hole to fall into. I'm first to admit I fell into it again recently. I didn't have the wherewithal or the motivation to keep my diet on track because I was just miserable. I was still eating plant-based and all, of course, but it wasn't healthy, and I certainly wasn't up there cooking up a storm. It was just whatever I could get that was easy and quick. And you know, food is medicine, right? And so movement and food are two obviously super super important ingredients to good mental health. And unfortunately, I think we all know that deep down, but sometimes the circumstances we're placed in make even those very simple things quite hard to stick to. And I guess in that case, you know, if you do fall off the wagon in that sense, don't be too hard on yourself, right? Like, life's a roller coaster, man. we all and that's what you said there, Emma, is that's it. Like people are far harsher. What's that saying? I'm going to mince my words here. But you know, there's that saying,
You're your own worst critic.
Treat yourself how you should treat others or something like that. Basically be kind to yourself, right? Yeah. I just completely minced that, but you know what I'm saying. We're really, really harsh. Our internal monologue so often is far harsher and crueler on ourselves than it should be. And it's certainly far harsher than we would treat others. That's kind of what I'm getting at. And so if you do, based on the circumstances, if you do slip, obviously be mindful of it, be aware of it, take note of it. But that shouldn't be the thing that lets you slip further down that hole. You know, you be mindful of it, but you need to obviously then start to climb back out, because it's a slippery slope otherwise, you know.
It's really important strategies, yeah. I think, and there is, like, it's so important to have that mindfulness aspect of it as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you may not be able to get out on the trails and run, but I can focus on the here and now, and I can do my squats and my lunges in my lounge room, and I can make this really delicious meal and, like, little bit. I know it's so hard to find, like, the gratitude aspect of things when you've been locked down for 11 weeks and you're missing your family. And, I mean, you guys, you're both athletes. You're used to being busy and moving and being on the go all the time. Yeah. So it's incredibly tough. But, yeah, just focusing on what you can control, even if it's the littlest, tiniest thing, you know, do that to the best of your ability.
I know. I can tell you guys follow Rich, because some of the, your little quotes you're saying, they just... they're like deja vu for me. I'm like, I've heard these before. And you're dead
Rich
right. Like,
I think Rich got those from us.
Yeah, yeah. But you, as any good podcast host does, you articulate them very well. So you've kind of summed up what I was mincing on about before in one. So, yeah, thank you for that.
And look, before we finish off, we did want to sort of give the opportunity for you to mention them, because they're a good organization and you're an ambassador for them. But the SPCA, how did that come about?
Yeah, I love my association with the SPCA. And how that came about was when I made the plant-based switch, within the agency I work with, it's an agency called We Are Tenzing. They have a very holistic model to athlete welfare and athlete management. And so essentially what that means is that they don't align people like myself with brands or causes unless they are intrinsically important to that person and something that they genuinely believe in. You know, you take your, well, there's plenty of great examples of the opposite throughout history. You know, the former rugby and rugby league players who push, you know, shoddy finance or life insurance or roofing or whatever because they get a big old check for it, but it can damage their brand on the back end, which in many cases it has. So in my particular case, you know, we were looking at what we call brand pillars, you know, pillars of my brand, brand John O'Lester, as you like. I hate saying that, but that's how they term it. And so for me, one of those pillars, particularly when I made the plant-based switch, was that I'd love to do something in terms of animal welfare, because as I learnt, I always thought of myself as an animal lover, but you realize once you go plant-based, you've actually just been a pet lover your whole life, and you learn what a real animal lover is once you make that switch. So another really, you know, profound realization for me. And so with that, that was top of my list insofar as charitable stuff is concerned. So we actually reached out to them and asked them if they had any ambassador programs in place, and turns out that they had been kind of mooting it internally for quite some time, but they hadn't really actioned anything yet. So we ended up working sort of directly with their comms team to put together a bit of an action plan for an ambassador program for the company, or for the organization. And I guess for better terms, give them a bit of a kick up the ass to make it happen. So we came in really, wouldn't say gung-ho, but very enthusiastic. And so I kind of led off alongside Karen Walker. She was the other ambassador that they launched with, if you like. And it's kind of grown from there. And look, our roles, I mean, there's no defined role of an ambassador as such. In my case, you kind of pick one or two of their key fundraisers each year, which you really sort of laser in on, and not only fundraise for, but obviously promote more actively than others. But then insofar as all of their other kind of awareness campaigns and all are concerned, obviously sharing those to, in many cases, a following that generally wouldn't be privy to information from the SPCA. Particularly myself, I was the only male ambassador until about 2 months ago. And so they really valued speaking to an audience of a higher percentage of men, because there's plenty of men who still love their pets and want to support organizations like the SPCA. So they kind of use me as a vehicle for that. But one of the things that I've done on top there, on top of, I guess, the general role, which I really enjoy, is as I went through the process of sort of being trained up to be one of their regular volunteers and at the Auckland Centre. And so I, that's something I've sort of done over the past year. And so I go in, again, pre-lockdown, go in once or twice a month, and you sort of spend half a day in there. I've done mine in the canine unit, so with the puppies and dogs and stuff, because I've always had cats at home. So I wanted a change, because I want a dog in my life when life's at the right point, and I've always wanted that in my future. So this is kind of my, you know, my little induction, if you like. And it's been incredibly fulfilling, not only personally, because there's always a selfish element to charity, you know. By doing good for others, you feel good yourself, and so that is intrinsically selfish. But if you can cover off both and obviously help them with their fundraising and their awareness and making sure that people, you know, not only treat animals better, but also are better equipped with the information to care for them better. It's all good, you know. It's all good. So it's very special to me to have that logo on my race suit and on my website, and to be able to represent them in the public space. So I think that's really cool. Makes me smile. So
it's making us all smile. So, Jono, this has been an absolute, 90 minutes. It's one of our longer ones for sure. But
I was going to say, is that a record?
No, I'm not sorry quite to say. We've come close to the two-hour mark. We learned our lesson with that one.
Awesome.
But no, on a serious note, it's been an absolute fascinating conversation. And you mentioned Rich Roll as an influencer in your change, and you describe him as an eloquent communicator. Well, I have to say, right back at you, the way you, I think your next job is motivational speaker.
Thank you.
it's what you bring. It's your personal journey. It's your personal reflections, and the lessons from that, and the way you present that. It's why people are akin to changing because of you. It's because of your approach, and we've spoken about that. We've spoken a lot about the importance of movement, which we're a big fan of, the importance of what you eat for your own personal health, and of course for the planet. You're in a challenging position, that whole conundrum, because you know your race and career is a little bit incongruent to that, but you know, you could be leading that change, and that's exciting. So I think there's a lot of inspiration we can derive from you. And like I said, this I think you're an influencer for sure in this regard. So a lot of praise, but it's been a fascinating chat. We really want to thank you for coming on the show. I know it's been a little bit of a challenging time recently with lockdowns and losing the meaning of life sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
But the future looks bright now.
It does.
I think you did right, Emma. And thank you for the kind words, Ben. Yeah, that means a lot. And hey, we've filled 90 minutes, so we've clearly done something right. But it's been really nice to talk about these different elements of my life that I'm passionate about, rather than just zoom zoom. Everyone asks about race cars and horsepower and engines, and I like talking about animals and food and
And
running.
plant
So I'm
power.
glad we got to do this.
And we can keep going, and I'm sure listeners are like, damn it, why did you cut him off? But there's only so much we can go on for. But who knows? We're definitely going to keep following your ambitions. Well, hopefully you'll get to the start line of Tarawera, because 2021
I'm
is a
pushing
write-off.
For it, man.
So, let's hope you get there. I've got a couple of athletes, doing the 100 miler, doing the 100K. I won't be there because I'll be hopefully, maybe on the South Island doing the old Ghost Ultra.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, let's.
That's a bucket lister for me too. Yeah.
It has been for me, so I'm hoping to tick that one off. But look, it's we're definitely going to follow your path, especially with the EVs, especially as well. And who knows? Bring you back on for part two at some point. So again, thank you so much, and look forward to keeping in touch.
Thanks, Jono.
Awesome, guys. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.